Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, the weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode number 269. Really, really excited to have Dave Bullwinkle, Snow Valley veteran coach, Chicago Bulls scout, just a lifer in the game. Really excited to see Coach Bullwinkle, or really excited to have Coach Bullwinkle on the podcast here this week. But before we bring in Coach, we of course want to thank our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha, Nebraska. Coaches, if you have an athlete who is struggling with balance, neck, or spinal issues, have them go see Cosac Chiropractic. Dr. Kevin, Dr. Heidi, give them a call. Check out their website, CosacChiro.com. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, please subscribe, please download, please rate, give us 5 stars, please review. Do all those things to help out A Pen and a Napkin kind of climb in the podcast universe. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. We've got our coaches clinic coming up here in 3 weeks. Actually, 3 weeks from right now. We're recording this on Saturday morning. And 3 weeks from right now, we are going to be at the A Pen and a Napkin coaches clinic. Got a great lineup. Get signed up today. We've just got a terrific group of speakers and presenters there. So amongst other things, but for here, for now, we are focused on Mr. Dave Bullwinkle out from the great state of California here and a scout for the Chicago Bulls. Coach Bullwinkle, thank you so much for your time this morning. I know you're really, really busy this time of year. You're doing a lot of scouting, prep work, all that other stuff. But Coach, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Marty, it's my pleasure. I mean, we both love basketball and being able to share maybe a few ideas that could help people. That's one of the great things that comes about.
You bet. So, well, Coach, let's just go ahead and dive right into it here. For folks that don't know about your basketball journey, tell us about your background, your what you've done in the game. You've been involved in the game for, you know, 50 plus years. And we don't use the O word on A Pen and a Napkin, Coach. We use seasoned and experienced. That is the phrasing that we use. So, Coach, tell us about your basketball journey.
I am seasoned and experienced. Coming out of college, I started as a high school coach. I was coaching football and basketball. I'd been not a very good college football player. First at Princeton where I started, then I transferred to the University of California at Berkeley and played there, the third string DB. Although I like basketball better. Uh-huh. When I got routine in those sports at 5'10", I thought I'd had a better shot as a DB.
Uh-huh.
And I was just slowly playing most of the Pac-8 then. I'm aging myself now in the Pac-8. So I've coached 4 years in high school, and I was offered an opportunity to go to the University of California at Berkeley as the grad assistant, which in those days was the third assistant on the staff. And I took that. I spent a long time, you know, who Stan Van Gundy and Jeff Van Gundy are. Well, their father, Bill, is a mentor of mine.
Yep.
At that time, he was the Division II coach in California and was my high school coach's best friend in basketball. And I actually spent 2 straight evenings over dinner with Bill. And Jeff and Stan were at the table, and Stan was a high school senior at that time. Stan would tell you the story because later on I worked for Stan. And we just kicked around whether or not I should roll the dice and try to be a college coach. To do it, I was going to take a 95% pay cut. And I decided to do it, and it worked out fine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work out for everybody. You work hard, you get lucky, combination thereof. And so that started 25 years of coaching in college. 16 as an assistant, 9 as a head coach, 5 at the Division II level in Southern California at Cal Poly Pomona University, and then 4 as a head coach at St. Mary's in California. Mm-hmm. And they fired my rear end in 2001 and hired Randy Bennett, and he's done a better job than me, including beating Vanderbilt in the tournament yesterday.
Yes, they did get the big win yesterday, so...
And the closest I was to where you are in Omaha, I was Stan Van Gundy's assistant at Wisconsin, and even 1 season there, Sue mm-hmm. Jackson had hired me mm-hmm. and moved on to take the job as the first DP for the Memphis Grizzlies in the NBA, and Stan stayed, and I was elevated by staying with Stan. He's just the whole Van Gundy family, wonderful people.
Yes.
So after I got fired at St. Mary's, I had to make a decision, and for a couple of reasons. I decided to leave college basketball. My father, my parents lived in the area, and he was in the last month of his life with leukemia. And my current wife had a good job in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area in East Bay. And my two children from a previous marriage were living here. So I said, you know, maybe I ought to make a decision where basketball is not the only reason now. And I left college coaching and started doing some part-time work, advanced X and O stuff for a couple teams in the NBA, as well as being the athletic director at a small private high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was fortunate enough to be hired first by the Sixers as their advanced X and O guy. So I was in NBA arenas doing the game preparation for a year. And at the same time, Gar Forman, who then was the director of scouting for the Bulls, had been talking with me. And he convinced John Paxton to make a mistake and hire me. And that was 20 years ago. And I don't tell the Bulls I don't know anything. They haven't figured it out yet. And when Arturis took over, when John stepped down 5 years ago, he saw fit to keep me. So now I've been with the Bulls in a scouting capacity for 20 years, seeing games all around the country. And I do Latin America for us also. So I see a lot of basketball.
Yeah. Yeah. The Karen Self, a pen and a napkin moment, Coach Bullwinkle, when was the first time that you can remember when you started, you took a pen or a pencil and started writing on a piece of paper or a napkin or whatever and really started getting serious about the X's and O's, the Karen Self, a pen and a napkin moment for Dave Bullwinkle?
I think as a high school coach, there was a group of us that were young high school coaches who would get together. We were all single at the time. Mm-hmm. We might end up someplace where we were hoping to meet someone of different sexual persuasion, maybe a young lady, but we'd have a few adult beverages and the pen and the napkin would be out.
Uh-huh.
But I'll tell you one that really sticks out. And you know this well because of having worked Snow Valley, Iowa, and the original Snow Valley basketball schools in California. And I remember being there, having an essay book. Someone is speaking. I'm at the back of the group. I'm taking notes. And as you know, then we sprint to the basket. We do the seat teaching. Then I come back to hear the guy talk again. And he's going to set up the next drill. I'm taking notes. And those essay books, that's where I really learned how to teach the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, more on Snow Valley later. You know, obviously that's a shared passion of both of us and a shared project here that we'll wait another couple of weeks here until that officially kind of gets taken care of there. But yeah, just the writing the stuff down, the binders, the things that you put together, and you know you know, speaking of Snow Valley, one of the real privileges is, like you said, Coach, you get to watch other people, you get to learn so much from watching other coaches teach the game. And you know, last summer was the first time, and we had talked about this previously, that I had gotten to watch you work the early morning sessions with the point guards. I was really excited about that, and I love the way that you ran your sessions. But it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different with how you do stuff, but it's also just, I loved it. I just absolutely love it. Where did that kind of teaching style come from? How do you organize your stuff as you're working with players, as you're working with kids, especially perimeter players? Let's just kind of dive in there and how does your mind work to kind of, you know, put things in that type of style?
Marty, let me ask you, you're saying what I do is a little bit different. Do you mean from an energy standpoint? It's like a usage of other coaches?
The usage of other coaches, it's bang here for 2 minutes. It's here for 3 minutes and then back to this for 2 minutes and then we're here for 4 minutes. And I mean, it was so efficient. It kept the kids on their toes. The communication was clear and concise. The every step, but it was so efficient with your verbiage, what you expected from the kids. I mean, all of those different things. I mean, I just loved working those with you, Coach.
Well, I think you've heard me say this with the coaches that are working with me in those sessions, is my job is to get it organized. You guys are really doing the teaching, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's in the station of work. My job is to keep things organized, keep things moving. I think some of it, you know, most of us, when we got out of college, before being teachers, we had to do some teacher education stuff.
Yeah.
And I had to get my master's degree in education and get a teacher credential to teach in the state of California. And it's amazing the things I look back that I thought was just BS at that time. But it turns out those things really carried weight to help me prepare to be a better teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was teaching U.S. government and U.S. history in high school, the students called me the frog because I'd be jumping around the room and moving. And that's just kind of, you see me, that's kind of my high energy personality.
Yeah.
As I've gotten older, I have to be better with the verbiage because I can't, you know, I don't have quite the same energy as 75 that I had at 25.
Uh-huh.
But I do think that utilizing the people that are with you, because they're all very knowledgeable. And that includes when you're in the classroom, for example, with the students.
Yeah.
I don't need to be the focal point. The important thing is that the young man or woman learn what we're teaching, whether it be in the corridor or in the classroom. And sometimes this will happen. You find that there seems to be a disconnect. Maybe it's my age, whatever, with the youngster. But this other youngster knows what you're talking about. Well, have him or her explain it to the one that doesn't understand. And their idioms or whatever may get the job done. The important thing is that the youngster that didn't understand, understands. Not that he learned it through me. So the same thing is true in working at Snow Valley with a group of coaches. It's not that I don't need to be the focal point. I want to get things organized and going. And then let the coaches who are very, very talented teach for that period of time and then bring it back and start the whole process over again with the next step in what we're trying to teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, some coaches, not all coaches, but there are some coaches. Well, if they don't get it from me and how I intend for them to get it, then they're not getting it the way that they should. Whereas, you know, as a head coach, you've got to turn over some of your teaching, at the very minimum, some, if not a lot of your teaching, to your assistant coaches, because your personality is not going to fit all 12 to 15 kids that you have on the varsity team or whatever your situation may be. I think that's so important to delegate at times that communication, whether sometimes it's just, you know, coach to player communication about their role on the team or different things like that. I've really tried to, whenever possible, let my assistant coaches have their say and communicate with the players and teach things, because, you know, your voice gets old as a head coach as well. I mean, I think that's a big part of it as well. Don't you think, Dave?
Very definitely. And I do believe one of the things that helped me in that regard is having played football in college, where you're definitely break up with different positions from a teaching standpoint. And the head coach very seldom is the person. He may even be up in a tower looking down.
Yeah.
That's helped me understand a little bit the value of assistant coaches. And of course, I was an assistant coach for 16 years in college. So I had a respect for assistant coaches only because I had that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, speaking of coaching, it's been, you know, it's been a minute since you've been on an official staff. Now, obviously, you've stayed very, very involved in the game and doing the job in that way. What are some things that you miss from the day-to-day grind of being part of a coaching staff, whether as a head coach or an assistant coach?
The first thing that I miss is what we were just discussing, is teaching.
Mm-hmm.
The practices.
Yep.
I miss the relationships that you develop with the players and the assistant coaches. I have two or three high school coaches in this area who were players for us when I was the head coach at St. Mary's. And to go to watch them play, which I do once in a while, is just a thrill. And that goes back to the relationships you have with the players.
Mm-hmm.
And so I miss that. And I miss the chess match at the end of games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I call it the kicking game in basketball, the third phase of the game, so to speak, special situations, when to foul late,
yep,
how to use substitutions, to use the horn to change the flow of the game because of when you put somebody in. I very much enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. What I don't miss is going into a game when you're so overmatched that you've got to be absolutely perfect to have a chance to win. And playing against Gonzaga my last couple of years as the head coach at St. Mary's, I had that feeling a few times, and that's no fun.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing is the teaching and the relationships. That's what that's what makes this game so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had a couple of people that have asked me, you know, since I sent out this season, you know, what do you miss? And I miss putting together a good practice plan and executing that plan and seeing the kids get better from 3:30 that day to 5:30 that day. And then by proxy, I miss, okay, here's what this group of people look like on November 15th. How can I get them to be their best on February 15th? You know, both as a basketball team, as basketball individuals, but also as people and trying to help them grow as people. I miss that process of things. That's probably the biggest thing I miss.
I think what you said about putting the practice together, as a college coach, if the practice was 2 hours, it probably took 3 hours in the morning to put the practice together. Mm-hmm. Trying to, all right, who do I match up where? How do I do the progression of drills? How the teaching pedagogy? How do we do that stuff? That was really, I hadn't thought about that, but that's a really fun part of the teaching. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Coaches, I am really excited to announce this year's lineup for our 5th annual Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. This year's clinic date is Saturday, April the 12th. It's going to take place at Mary R. Queen Gymnasium, located at 3405 South 119th Street here in Omaha. We've got three on-court demonstrators. Andy King, the head boys basketball coach at Elkhorn North High School, will get the day started with his clinic on developing your team through 5-on-5 controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer, my good friend from Iowa State University, the associate head coach at Iowa State with the women's basketball team, is going to talk about individual player development in small group settings. Jamie Smith, the head girls basketball coach at Solon High School in Iowa, one of the best I've ever seen, teach about shooting fundamentals, is going to talk to us about how to put together a great shooting workout for your players. Coach Smith won a state championship last year at the Class 3A level in Iowa. Those are three on-court demonstrators. Then we're going to have three off-court demonstrators. Our lunch keynote speaker is my guy Raz Vanderloo, the head boys basketball coach at Sioux City East High School. And also Raz is very involved with USA Basketball. I'm just going to let Raz cook. He's going to talk to us just with a basketball smorgasbord of topics about what Raz wants to talk about that day. Then we're going to have two smaller breakout sessions. Lucas Dollinghouse, the head boys basketball coach at Johnson Brock here in high school, highly successful program. He's also an administrator, and he's going to talk about coaching through an administrator's eyes along with some other things. Our other breakout session is weekday Wade Coulter, the head girls basketball coach at Gretna East High School, and he's going to talk about building a pressure defensive system. One of the great things about the Pen and a Napkin Clinic is, in addition to our presenters, we also have two designated breakout sessions where you will get the opportunity to discuss various topics with other coaches attending the clinic. These sessions are a great way to pick the brains of your peers at the clinic, and it's one of the most enjoyable points of our annual clinic. And then, hey, after a long day of learning about hoops, it's time to kick back and relax. We're going to have an optional post-clinic social at Wine 121. It's right down the street from Mary R. Queen, about a mile and a half down the road. I want to thank my friend TK, Tom Crable, for opening his doors to the clinic again. It's just $15 per coach for anybody that wants to join us there. Our Pen and a Napkin Clinic is one of the most affordable clinics in America. I mean, it is really, really, really affordable. You're going to get over 7 hours worth of information. That's $60 for a coach. If you're just a singular coach that wants to come up and check it out, it's $60 a coach. If you bring yourself and another coach from your staff, it's $110. Three coaches from your staff, $150. If you bring four or more coaches from your staff, it is only $45 per coach. We've got a sliding scale. It's all about getting better at an affordable price. So if you are interested in signing up for our Pen and a Napkin Clinic, look to the flyer on Twitter and mail it in. You can scan it in. You can do all those different things, or you can DM me on Twitter, or you can email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Registrations are due by Thursday, April the 10th, 2025. Coaches, do not miss out on one of the best coaching clinics in America. Coach, what, you know, you've been fortunate to be around the game for a long time. What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen in your career from the time that you started as a high school coach to now and scouting, you know, all over North America?
I'm not mistaken. I think there are 10 or 12 states in America that have the shot clock for high school basketball. Mm. It should be all of them.
Yeah.
Because it really makes a difference in the development of players. And where I live, now, we did not have a shot clock when I was a high school coach. But in California, they implemented the shot clock probably 25 years ago, maybe more. The shot clock, the three-point shot, how that's changed the game. And the other thing I would say, the international and I say international, but maybe more European influence on the game in terms of style of play. When I took over doing Latin America for the Bulls, and I would see more international basketball. Yeah. I really learned to appreciate that open court sort of game on the half court when it's not just somebody buried in the low post. I do think there's a value if you got I got Olajuwon, I'm playing him down there low, right?
Yeah.
But they're also the way the European approach to teaching basketball in terms of the big players can play inside and out and the little players can play outside and in.
Yeah.
I think that's really helped to make the game better.
Yeah.
I wait. That when I was a college coach, I would have been exposed more to international basketball, and maybe I would have been a good enough coach then not to get fired. That would have been nice, huh? And I say that because my last couple of teams in college at St. Mary's, I didn't have a good four-man, but I was insistent on playing 4 and 5 rather than just playing.
Yeah, you had to play with two post players.
You got it.
Yeah.
And I was hard-headed. And I have a couple players. One, O'Neal Kamaka, who's the college coach in Toronto. And he's originally he's from the Bahamas, but grew up in Toronto. And I tell him all the time that I misused you. I should have, I had him and another player named Frank Knight. And they kind of split time at the two spot. Well, I should have just gone small and played both of them.
Yeah.
We would have been better. And so I think that influence of the European style of basketball has been, I don't think it's as important as the shot clock and the three-point shot, but it's certainly amongst the three things that I think I've seen change most in the 60 years I've been involved in basketball.
Well, I think that what I, again, I'm kind of dating myself here, but the Mark Jackson back you down and pound the ball 162 times to post up and then wait for the double team, for years and years and years, you're talking about that European influence, they physically could not match up with the American players from a strength and athleticism. So necessity is the mother of invention. So how do we beat the Americans? Well, we've got to spread the floor. We've got to emphasize skill. We've got to emphasize shooting and all of those different type of things. It's kind of like you mentioned your experiences in football. I've kind of always made the comparison of the quote unquote Euro style to the run and shoot or the spread offenses in football. We don't have 5 320-pound offensive linemen that we can line up here with a 245-pound fullback and all these different things. We've got to figure out how to beat Michigan or Ohio State a different way. It took us getting hit in the chin a few times before we were like, hey, that stuff might make some sense for us here. And, better late to the party than never getting there. But that's kind of the way I've seen the evolution of it. Coach, is that an apt comparison?
I really think it is. You can look at different sports and draw those kind of analogies. I think it's very true.
Mm-hmm. Coach, you do a lot of really good stuff with talking to corporate entities and speaking about putting teams together. One of the years I was at Snow Valley, I saw one of your presentations late one night. I was in a fog after 16 hours on the floor or whatever, but I distinctly remember it, and it was a terrific presentation. One of your biggest things is getting teams to work together and function as a team. And if you coach this game long enough, I don't care who you are, you're going to come up with a group of players that should fit together but don't fit together, and whether, you know, for a variety of different reasons, but taking those personalities, taking those skill sets, all those different things, and putting together and making a team work. You know, what are some of the things that, as you examine, whether it's corporate America or basketball teams or any type of sports teams or whatever it may be, what are some of the key things that coaches or leaders should be doing to bring people onto the same page together and making the best team that they can possible?
Oh, when I got fired in 2001, I didn't know what I was going to do. Uh-huh. And I had a couple high school coaches that asked me, actually independently, could you get a program together, because they knew some things I'd done leadership-wise and teamwork-wise with our teams at St. Mary's. Put something together for my team. And that sort of jump-started this process, because I had a passion for teamwork. And one of the things I developed, in addition to programs and morphed into doing stuff with a lot of corporations, was what I call 5 characteristics of championship teams. If you've read The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, written by Patrick Lencioni.
Great book.
My 5 characteristics of teams, and I did this before Lencioni, but he made a lot of more money on it, is almost the inverse of his. And by the way, I love his stuff too. And so here's what I look as the 5 characteristics of championship teams. No, the first thing is a shared vision, which often I refer to as being purpose-centered. That means you've got to get everybody on the same page and pulling in the same direction. Now, we all have individual objectives, no question. We've got goals and things we want to accomplish. But we've got to get the people that we're working with on our team to subjugate their personal agenda for the team agenda. Yeah. And this, by the way, I see this happen in the corporate sector. I didn't really understand that because I was a darn basketball coach.
Yeah.
But then I started seeing the corporate same thing. And trust. You've got to develop a sense of trust. You can't get anything accomplished without that. You need to have people that are caring and compassionate for each other, okay? Yep. That they care about each other. And this helps you build a sense of synergy, where 2 + 2 = 5. And the last one is, it's got to be enjoyable. Now, I differentiate between having fun and being enjoyable.
Yep.
To me, if I said, okay, well, the fifth characteristic is fun, sometimes fun to me connotates the concept of just kind of giddy.
Yeah.
No, you could have enjoyment while you work really hard. It may not be fun, that hard work, but you enjoy the fact that you see you getting better. And if it's not enjoyable, then the people on the team aren't going to come back day after day, week after week to work. So it's got to, to me, the characteristics of championship teams are a shared vision, trust, compassion, synergy, and enjoyment.
Yeah.
And if you can get that built into your culture, then I think that carries over. And I think I use the buzzword there, culture. But we talked a little bit about teams and relationships. I remember hearing Larry Brown say one time, I get paid to teach, not to get people to work hard. That's your job. Well, I think if your best players are your hardest workers, and if you can get the players, your better players, to buy into what I'm talking about here, dealing with teamwork, and I was fortunate enough to have that in a few situations, then that's when the game becomes really enjoyable.
Uh-huh.
Because the team runs the team. It's not just you.
Yeah. What are some things that you do to get those best players to be your hardest workers? I mean, some of that is natural, you know, natural drive, but you know, how do you get a kid that might be on the fence with you to buy into what Coach Bullwinkle is selling here? How do you get them to have them become your hardest workers, not just good workers, but hardest workers, and to get them to give themselves up for their individual, give up some of their individual for the good of the team? What's part of the process there, Coach?
Yeah, it's some of that. You have to give up some of your sense of power.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to be, as I said, when we were talking about when we were here in the Snow Valley. Yes, do I get people organized? Correct. But I don't have to be the focal point. If you're in a workshop that I'm doing on teamwork and leadership development, I always tell people, you're going to learn more from each other than you're going to learn from me. Mm-hmm. My job is just to ask the right questions to stimulate the conversation. Now, let's transfer that to the teams. When you're working with your high school or college team, I think it's important you empower the players and give them. I heard Bobby Knight say this one time that sounds really strange, but I let the players make all the unimportant decisions.
Yep. Yep.
What time are we going to practice tomorrow? Things of that nature. But I think you can go even beyond that. Whenever possible, I look for situations where I can empower the players. They know in the final analysis I'm going to make a decision, maybe if it has to be made. But if I can rely upon them to do it, for example, I go in the locker room at halftime. And in college, you have 15 minutes. Well, we're going to warm up the last five because I believe if you don't warm up before the second half, you may lose the game before the first meeting timeout in the second half.
Yep.
So we're going to warm up for five. I'm going to talk to my assistants for five. And the five in between when I'm talking to the team, the first thing I ask them is, what do you see out there?
Yeah.
Because they're going to see 90% of what you see.
Yeah.
And if they articulate it, they're more likely to buy into it because it's them that said it, not you preaching down to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you can give, empower and give a sense of ownership, develop that sense of ownership with your players, then I think they start to buy in and work harder too.
Yeah. One of the things, I picked this up from Don Meyer, and I did it every single game that I was a head coach. In that, you know, in high school, we had 10 minutes. So, you know, probably you know, 2 or 3 minutes.
No.
Yeah. 2 or 3 minutes with the assistant coaches, 3-ish minutes with the players. Hopefully that's just it. And then, you know, get them out with about 4 minutes. But in that 2 or 3 minutes that I'm talking with our assistants, we had someone, I didn't care who it was, but we had a dry erase marker and they were required to write down on the board 2 or 3 things that we did well in the first half, 2 or 3 things that we've got to do better in the second half. And I would say 80 to 90% of the time when we walked into the locker room, it was almost to a T what we had talked about in the hallway, but especially on those things that we needed to do better in the second half. Hey, you've already said what we need to do here. You realize it. Now you got to go out and do it, kids. And to me, that made you not be the heavy every single time. You know, they have, okay, we recognize that we need to do this. We recognize that we can control this. Henceforth, it's on us to get it done because we are the team and we control what we are doing moving forward. And I think that's a great way to look at it as well.
I couldn't agree more. The more you can do that. And now let's go back to what you said about starting November 15th and going through February 15th. And you talked about developing the team, their basketball skills, but also helping to develop them as people. Well, that's what we're doing also.
Yeah.
We're helping develop young leaders. One of the things that hurts us now in terms of athletics in our country, in my opinion, is that I've been called the Little League syndrome, where there always has to be a parent providing direction.
Oh, yeah.
How often we drive back past the park and see the kids choosing up teams and playing on their own? That's where some of that leadership develops. Yes, never. So the more times we can put players in situations where they have to be the leader, it's going to help your team grow, but it's helping them grow as individuals as well, which I think we have to keep in the forefront.
We tried to do that a couple of summers ago, and I was just like, we're going to open up the gym a couple of times a week, and we're going to just let the kids come in and just shoot, just like, you know, back in the day. Now this we had organized workouts throughout the week as well, but here's a little bonus time and just let the kids come in and do their thing. And oh my gosh, you would have thought that I had, you know, I don't know, I had committed the worst crime in the history of mankind. But I wanted to turn that back over to the kids. I wanted to, you know, I play again Gen X, okay, full and through. I played my first organized sporting activities against another town. My first baseball game that I ever did that, and I grew up in a small town in Iowa, I think was fifth grade, first football game I ever played against another town with, you know, anybody was seventh grade, same thing for basketball. Whereas my kids, by the time they got to seventh grade, they probably played in more organized sporting events. And that's what I mean by that is having official scores with scoreboards and officials and different things like that. By the time they were in seventh grade, they had played more of those games than I had my entire life in high school, you know. But we figured it out by choosing teams on the playground, choosing teams at the ball diamond, choosing teams on the asphalt, calling your own fouls, you know, figuring things like that out. And I think, not to sound like the grumpy old man yelling at the clouds, but I think we've lost some of that. And henceforth, it does make it more difficult to get your kids to think outside of the box of how are we going to do things that they've been told what to do instead of having to think on their own on how to do those things. And I think we're missing that in a lot of things that we've got going on with our youth today.
No, I was a high school coach. I was a JV coach, and I organized a JV summer league.
Yep.
And the way I set the summer league up was you didn't play with – I reached out to high school coaches all around the East Bay. You wouldn't necessarily play with the same kids you played with in high school. We just pair these teams up and make them kind of equal. And the kids would coach themselves, and that's what we did. And two nights a week, they played at the high school I was at. We had a JV summer league. I remember I had this one JV coach from another school in the district complaining of, oh no, it was a parent complaining about, you know, something, these officials or whatever. And I told him, I said, look, you just take your son and leave. Okay. And these people started ranting at me. And I said, yeah, well, this is the reason I've got 20 kids, half of which are going to get cut that are playing in this league. You've got one or two. It's part of the reason we're going to kick your butt. But part of the reason was I was having the kids coach themselves. Mm-hmm. I can remember, now I'm older than you, Marty, but I remember as a high school coach, I have fond memories of this. I played for a great high school coach. But in those days, in summer league, they couldn't coach the team. We had to coach ourselves. Mm-hmm. He would sit in the stands and watch. But every day during the summer, he opened the gym in the afternoon. And the best players, not just the best players, all the players from all the surrounding high schools knew that that gym would be open. And we'd choose up teams and play. And if you lost, you might be sitting for 2 hours.
Yep.
So you wanted to win. And we would play 4 hours every afternoon. And here I am at age 75, thinking back to something I did at age 17. But I've got fond memories of that. Mm-hmm. And some of it ties into just what you're saying. We don't need to have adults running the show all the time. And that will help us develop better leaders in our country. And God knows we need them.
Yep. Coaches, are you looking for a way to improve not only your players, but your parents' perspectives on what they should expect when they come to your program at the high school level? Well, a pen and a napkin has something for you, your families, your players, your parents, and maybe even yourself as well. Varsity Preparation Academy. The first annual Varsity Preparation Academy is going to take place May 3rd and 4th, 2025, here in Omaha, Nebraska, at Omaha Marion High School. That's at 7400 Military Avenue here in Omaha. This is for girls basketball players grades 6 through 9 going into the 25-26 school year. VPA is all about educating parents and players to prepare themselves for the varsity sports experience, both on and off the floor. I'm taking all the things that I've learned in my career from all the camps that I've gone to, all the camps that I've worked, all the stuff that I've done on my own here, from USA Basketball to Snow Valley to Point Guard College to the stuff that I've done. And we're combining it all into one really, really intense weekend to help these future varsity athletes get ready for the varsity level. We're going to work on skill sessions on the floor. We're going to have many sessions on the floor talking about important things about the, you know, like why coaches substitute, the importance of routine, different things like that. And then we're going to have classroom sessions where we're going to sit down and talk about different things that are going to be important for the development of the player and the parent. We're also going to have a parent meeting to talk to parents about what to expect in the high school experience, what they should be looking for as their child goes through this. So, coaches, Pass this on to your players, to your parents. I think it's going to be a really, really good deal. It's $175 for the weekend. That's literally less than $10 an hour that they're going to pay to get this great experience. T-shirts, binders for note-taking, all sorts of different things. Meals are going to be provided. We are going to take care of your players and your parents. A Pen and a Napkin is going to be there to help you out. Always done that, and we're going to do this once again on a different wavelength, on a different level, with the first annual Varsity Preparation Academy, May 3rd and 4th, 2025, here in Omaha, Nebraska. Coach, at this time, we are going to jump into our John Wooden quote of the day. Each week, we take a quote from John Wooden, from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. And I give my guests the quote, and we kind of chop it up for a few minutes, gauge your reaction to it, and we'll just kind of take it from there. So, Coach Bullwinkle, are you ready for the John Wooden quote of the day?
I am waiting with bated breath.
Thank you. The John Wooden quote of the day, from page 114 of Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations, is: the most essential thing for a leader to have is the respect of those under his or her supervision. It starts with giving respect. You must make it clear that you are working together. Those under your supervision are not working for you, but with you, and you will have a common goal. And I have chills on my arms right now because we literally have just spent 5 minutes talking about that.
Yeah, we just did. No question about it. And it goes back to empowering those that you work with and respecting them. He says, Coach Wooden said that respect is basically a two-way street here. I think loyalty is as well. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in our this day and age and a lot of things, too many people in positions of power think loyalty is a one-way street, and it's not. It goes both directions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think Coach Wooden, I mean, he was, I had the privilege one time at the Final Four in Atlanta. A friend of mine who had worked his basketball camps, we were sitting at a coffee shop late at night, maybe doing pen and napkin work.
You bet.
And Coach Wooden walked in late at night to have a sandwich. And my friend Bill said, do you want to join us? And for an hour, I had the privilege of listening to him talk in person. And, you know, it's funny to talk about the quality of college basketball going on in the tournament right now. I was talking with a friend yesterday. Are there great teams? And I'm afraid I'm kind of jaded because I grew up watching all of Wooden's great teams play. Those teams dominated. I mean, they win every game. We all know that UConn has won, like, what now, 13 straight games by more than 13 points or whatever it is in the NCAA tournament. But that was standard operating procedure for the Wooden teams in the late 60s and early 70s, mid-70s. It's just amazing to think of what he did with those teams.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just the greatest teacher, perhaps, of all time. And that's classroom teacher. You know, his classroom was a gymnasium. Long before that, he was an English teacher, you know, and you know, obviously on a pen and a napkin, on a lot of different things that we do, we spend a lot of time talking about Coach Wooden. And we're just blessed that he was willing to share as much as he did with the rest of us. You know, he didn't have to do that. He chose to do it. So wholeheartedly agree with you, Coach. That's great.
I sent a text to Matt Painter after they beat UCLA this year in the Big Ten, which makes no sense, by the way, UCLA beating the Big Ten. But I sent him a note saying the game was at Mackey Arena. I sent Matt a note saying that Coach Wood may have coached UCLA because, you know, he played at Purdue.
Yep.
He may only coach UCLA, but someplace up there is looking down with a smile on his face because the Boilermakers won.
Yeah. Yeah. Just how fragile things are. I mean, you know, a lot of people know that, you know, Wooden was offered the UCLA job, but Minnesota also wanted him. And the only reason he didn't go to Minnesota was because of down telephone lines, because of a blizzard and all that other stuff. But also I had learned later on that Purdue tried to get him to come back and coach after he was at UCLA for a couple of years. But UCLA, A, UCLA wouldn't release him from his contract, and B, Wooden had signed a 3-year contract and he was only in year 2, and he felt like he would be shortchanging UCLA because he wanted to keep his word for signing the 3-year contract. And you know, so I mean, it's just those ships passing in the night in the stories of the game and the history of the game. Who knows what we would have been talking about with John Wooden at Purdue? And I agree with you. I think as much as he won at UCLA, I think his heart was probably always kind of in the Midwest, and especially, you know, obviously his high school sweetheart Nelly and growing up in Indiana and all that stuff too. So
yes, he definitely was a Hoosier.
Yeah. So coach, you see a lot of coaches. You see a ton of coaches. You see a lot of different coaches. You get to educate yourself and watch how other coaches operate. What are some ways as you watch other coaches work, what are some ways that coaches can simplify their jobs?
Well, a lot of times, you know, the things we've talked about before, that you don't have to be the sole focal point. Uh-huh. Hire assistants who are good and who you trust. And my standard answer, I think, for the best answer I could give if I'm interviewing for an assistant coach's job, when the head coach asks, well, what's the best thing you can do to help me? And the answer is anything that makes your job easier. Mm-hmm. I had an assistant one time when I was the Division II head coach, Kevin Patterson, who I met in Snow Valley, California, mm-hmm. and ended up hiring him, was just phenomenal. Little things like Division II, we win the game, the media is going to be like two local beat writers from the local fish wrapper, right? And I'm talking with them, and I come back to the locker room, and you're on the road, and my briefcase and raincoat was already in the van. I didn't have he didn't have to do that. You know, anything you can do to make the head coach's job easier, I think that's really important. You may or may not know that the NABC, the National Association of Basketball Coaches, started a mentoring program, taking an old guy like me and pairing up with some young guy. And actually, the young guy they paired me up with is a grad assistant at Cal State Northridge, and we're going to meet at the Final Four. But we've had 2 meetings already. In an effort to share ideas on just this, and that's one of the things I said to Alex, the best thing you can do is anything you can do to help make your job, head coach's job easier. Mm-hmm. I think another factor is this happens to all of us. Our sense of self-worth gets tied up into whether we win or not.
Yeah.
And we've got to separate ourselves from that. Yeah. My last team at St. Mary's lost 17 games in a row. Now, some of them are close and some of them are overtime, but the bottom line is we lost 17 games in a row and we weren't very good. I was still a pretty good coach. Now, I wasn't John Wooden, but I wasn't some, you know, awful coach either. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things just happen you can't overcome, and don't get your whole sense of self-worth tied up, and understand you can separate yourself from the game and still have a good time. And I think this is also a factor. I have a good friend who was let go as the head coach at Northern Arizona. This is about a dozen years ago. And he was devastated. He wanted to get back in coach. I said, Mike, you know, if you don't get back in coaching, there are other things out there you can do in athletics that you're going to find to be very, very rewarding. And you don't have to just be a head coach or an assistant coach. And that's part of what I found out. First being an athletic director at a high school and then getting into the NBA But I'll tell you what's a common thread in that, and I know you're going to talk about it in a couple of weeks. That's Snow Valley. Mm-hmm. Meeting men and women such as yourself that are coaches that you learn from, and they excite me. So I think that some of it is understanding that maybe winning and losing, yes, it's important, and it keeps you your job. I fully understand that. I've had my rear end fired. But it's not the only thing that makes you worthy of being the coach.
Yeah.
Your sense of self-worth goes beyond that. Mm-hmm. Some of it deals with the relationship we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I think understanding that your whole sense of self-worth should not be tied to winning and losing, and then being successful, hiring good people to work with, mm-hmm. It's just a huge deal. And sometimes you don't have the choice. There are situations where I didn't get the assistant I wanted to hire because I didn't have enough money for him.
Yep.
But within those confines, getting the best people you can to work with.
Yep. What, you know, as we all know, March and April is job season in our profession.
I got a text last night from someone who had just been fired at a job and wanted to talk, and we're going to talk tomorrow. Just kicking around the ideas of how to move forward. And you're right. I know where you're going. This is not a fun time for.
Well, it's a high time for those that get the job. It's a low time for those that are not employed, you know, and sometimes even as a coach, you are looking for a job, even though you've already got a job, you know? I would say it's probably the process of it is dirtier than it ever has been, to use a word. I don't know if that's an accurate word or not, but it's, the ethics are a little bit more skewed perhaps than they ever have been. But regardless, however a job comes about, what do you think, some of the key components, should, what are some of the key components that a coach should be looking at in a potential job? And let's kind of talk about head coaching jobs here, Dave. You know, if you're looking at, I'm going to take this job at West High School or Northwest State or wherever the heck it is, what are some of the key things generally that coaches should be looking at?
Well, first I'm going to say something that's the exception of the rule that I happened to overhear the other day. And that was a young man who's a very successful assistant coach in a powerful program that could be in the Final Four this year. And he's talking with his agent. And the key factor of schools was, what is their NIL budget? How about that? I saw things have changed.
Yep.
I would say the most important thing is the athletic director who you're going to directly report to. I was very fortunate when I was a Division II head coach. The athletic director is a woman named Karen Miller, far and away the best athletic administrator I ever was around. Every single game they played, now I know in that conference at that time, which was the Division II conference of Southern California, the men and women would play opposite sides. So she did the home games. If we were on the road, this wouldn't happen. But every game she was at that I was coaching in, when I came out of the locker room after the game, she was there. And she would say, hey, let's go have a beer to celebrate, or let's go have a glass of wine to commiserate.
Yeah.
Or if I needed my butt chewed, she would chew it, and then she still had my back. Finding an administrator, that the administrator is a big factor there. Yeah. When I was a high school coach, the last place I coached in high school, I had this young man on the team, and he was a good player. And should have played more than he was, but he was not a team player and he wouldn't guard. Well, so his father, as happens sometimes in this day and age, wanted to talk to me about it. So I said, sure, I'm in my office, I'm in my classroom at 7:30 every morning, come on in. So he came in and he prefaced his speech with his lengthy CYO coaching background and explained that you don't win with defense and so forth. And I said, look, and finally at the end of the conversation, I said, we've reached the impasse, Mr. Schomer. Your son, Prince, is not going to play more until he either passes the ball more and guards better. And I think he can. But we've reached an impasse and I've been entrusted with coaching the team. Well, I get a phone call first period from the principal secretary. And she says to me, Mr. Cowan, who, by the way, had been a Division II basketball assistant one time, would like to speak with you in your prep period. Okay, so I'll go down. And the first thing he says to me is, did Mr. Schomer meet with you today? Well, he can see the hairs on the back of my neck getting up. And he says, Dave, I just want to know what transpired. So when he calls me back, I can tell him to go to hell. How many of you have administrators like that?
Correct.
Yes. Finding, having somebody that's got your back. I think that's really important. Now, you've got to have their back too. Remember, we're talking about things going both directions.
Both ways. But, absolutely.
Yes. But I think that's very, really, really important. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then another thing I did, and I was a college assistant for 16 years and changed jobs. I never changed jobs for money. I changed jobs for responsibility. Mm-hmm. I wanted to develop myself to become a head coach. So as an assistant, I took jobs where my responsibilities would grow to help prepare me to be a head coach. So I think those things were important. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to grow myself, and I wanted to be with an administrator who had your back.
Yeah. I always looked for an AD who had walked a mile in my shoes. Like I could go in and say, here's what's going on, blah, 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 this and that. And they could say, yep, I get it. I've been there. I've done that. Here is what I did do. Here is what I would do differently. I know exactly what you're going through. And kind of at the end of it, you know, I've got your back. I think that is so very valuable in having that relationship, because, you know, you just have to have it. You just have to have that. And it's okay. If I screw up, tell me I screw up. However you want to tell me how I screwed up, I can take it. I'm a man. I can understand this. I'm a professional. We're all going to make mistakes. Please call me on any mistakes that I make. But you know what? Also point out what I do well as well. You know, and those are a couple of things that I would look for as well.
I was trying to resist him when going to Karen Miller. She had no problem shooting my rear end when it needed to be done.
Yeah.
But she had my back. Mm-hmm. And having someone like that, and I'm, you know, when I, during the 2 years I was an athletic director, the lessons I learned observing Karen Miller, I think helped me be a better athletic director.
Yep. Want to know more about A Pen and a Napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Coach, let's talk about your day job here a little bit. The last 20 plus years you've been with the Chicago Bulls. A lot of people are somewhat familiar with the draft process, but kind of take us through as much as you can. And again, like we had talked about before we started, you know, you got to protect the property of the Chicago Bulls and everything like that. So share what you can. And if you can't, absolutely no problem. But as you are looking at kids, you're scouting players, different things like that, take us through the process of a typical draft pick from kind of start to finish by the time that player's name is called in late June by Adam Silver or Mark Tatum. What is that process that happens? And I know you can only speak for the Bulls, but I'm sure you've probably been familiar with other organizations as well. Kind of what goes into that process to finally making that decision?
Well, we start seeing the players at a very young age. Now, when I started with the Bulls, there were very few high school things we were allowed to go to. That has changed over the last 7 or 8 years. And a lot of teams have hired some guy who might have been a writer or, you know, prognosticator about where kids are going to go to play in college as their grassroots person to look at, to be at the Nike's Peach Jam or the Adidas Championship or Under Armour. In our case, most of that's done by me. And I'll have some young guy in the office that may assist me with it. And I think one of the reasons that's beneficial in using me, and not just a relatively young person, is that having coached as long as I did, including in high school, you get a sense of feel of developmental potential. Some players, look, I was a good high school player, but I was 5'10". I wasn't especially fast and quick. I might have been all this and all that, but I had no major college potential. So you need to be able to separate that. So I see a lot of the young players that might be at USA basketball events. It might be at BWB events like BW Africa or America. Forget the academy games that brings together all the NBA academies. You watched Kamen Mal watch the big young center for Duke play yesterday. Well, that's the first place I saw him was 3 years ago at the academy games when he was 15 or 16. So we start tracking guys very early. That doesn't mean that other players might not creep in there, but we're certainly watching players early. Part of my job is to make sure that our vice president for basketball operations and our general manager and the assistant general managers that are above me, they know where not to go, mm-hmm. not to waste their time. My job is to get in front of them and make sure we understand I'm an information gatherer, suggestion maker. I have no problems making my suggestion very strongly, but they're not always taken.
Yep.
And nor should they be. Yep. And sometimes I'm right, and there's a time or two I've been wrong. But I think we're starting to watch players play in college, and part of my job is to separate the wheat from the chaff and let the people above me know where they should go. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, I'll see – people think I see a lot of great basketball, and I do. I do see a lot of great basketball. I see more bad basketball because I may be going to see – for example – most of your listeners don't know where UC Davis is, but it's halfway between the Bay Area and Sacramento. And Jim Les, who was the coach at Bradley at one time, he's the coach there.
Yep.
And they had a kid named T.Y. By the way, it's not Ty, it's T.Y. That's the name. It's T.Y. Johnson, who started this year scoring a lot of points. Now, they're low D1 in the Big West Conference. Mm-hmm. Well, I saw them play at home early in the year to make sure that this kid averaging 26 points a game, and it, as the year went along, is points per game drop, but then it's a fifth year senior that we don't need to see him. We don't need to have somebody above to go see him. So you see a lot of that sort of basketball too. No. I mean, I was in the Big East tournament last week and I'm watching St. John's and Creighton, and, you know, Marquette. And I've seen some really good teams, but you also see some teams that aren't so good in doing what in our organization we call dumpster diving. And that means we're looking at the low Division II schools, the lower Division I, just to make sure somebody doesn't fall through the cracks. Now, in this day and age, it's not like years gone by. 30 years ago, you could find Scottie Pippen in a little small school.
Yep.
That's not happened. Most of the big schools know these guys. They're much more thorough now for a lot of reasons, but you still need to keep your eye out for that, and that's part of my job. I do a lot of background work. We do a lot of digging to find out what makes a player tick. So typically, if I'm at a game, I'm there 90 minutes before the tip. I'm watching, I'm studying his shot, because then I may get to see this kid shoot 150 jump shots an hour before the game, or in the game, he may shoot three.
Yep.
And I can adjust my angle and see his hand placement on the ball, and his shot, is it a broke stroke or is it something, if he's willing to work at it, can be fixed a little bit. So I'm studying that. And we've put players on tiers to know who we want to watch closely. I do a lot of film work. I've got four European players. I don't go to Europe for us, so I have to study on film and write reports up on this week. And then as this thing progresses, you have the combine and workouts. But, you know, those things are, yes, you're watching them play basketball, but they're really more important for the interview process and the physical testing. Mm-hmm. So I would say that in deciding, these are factors in who you're drafting. Number one, not necessarily in order of importance, trainability. Your athletic physical development people are giving you a good idea what is his athletic potential, and that's from the testing.
Yep.
The medical people, does he have a history of injury or potential injury? And your doctors are looking at that. The analytics are a factor, okay? because the work we do to find background wise to find out what makes them tick, and then the intuitive eye. That's me. I'm the old guy. The intuitive eye is where you think his potential is and what he does well. Because in evaluating players, I believe in coming into the NBA, the great players do a lot of things. Steph, LeBron, yeah. They do many, many things. Most of the players that get on the floor do one thing well. Now, they may do some other things okay.
Yeah.
But one thing's going to get him into the game. I'm looking for, does he have the requisite level of athleticism? He doesn't have to be MJ, but he can't be me, right? And what's the one thing that's going to get him into an NBA game? And then the intangibles. And so some of those go back to what we talked about earlier about teamwork and team orientation and work habits.
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of things. And when I go to a game early and I'm studying what he's doing shooting-wise, I'm also talking to the trainer. And I'm asking the trainer typical questions for me to their strength coach is, who's your hardest worker in the weight room? Who's the hardest worker for you? And if he gives me three guys and he hasn't got to the guy that I'm looking at, and they're saying, well, why do you mention Marty's name? Well, he knows what he's supposed to do, but he's not always on time. He's not always committed. Okay. Now, that may not be if the guy has immense talent, that may not be a deal breaker, but it's certainly a red flag that I'm noting.
Yeah.
So asking people questions.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. One of the things, I was doing a workshop for a large corporate group in the fall. And someone said, what do you think is your best skill in your job that you do for the Bulls in terms of vetting people? I said, I'm just smart enough, not stupid. I'm going to listen to what you have to say. I don't have the answers. I'm just going to work on the questions. Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the things that go into the process.
Mm-hmm.
And then people think what's going on in the draft room on draft night really is kind of boring. Okay, because we've done most all the work beforehand.
Yeah.
Now, if we're on the phones, and that would be people above me, on the phones working on a possible trade or something, there's some there can be some exciting moments. But for the most part, you know, I wish it was like 1 minute between selections instead of 10.
Well, that's what I was thinking. That would be like the Thunderbolt moment is if there's a trade that comes out of nowhere and a team leapfrogs three other teams and takes somebody, and then you got to reshuffle your deck there a little bit. I think that is the stuff on draft night that throws everything for a loop. I mean, you've got a good idea of, you know, this team's going to take this guy, this team's going to take this guy. Okay, we've got the fourth pick or we've got the eighth pick. More than likely, it's going to be either this dude or this dude. But if somebody leapfrogs and, yeah, I would think that would be the part that throws stuff into chaos.
The inverse can happen. We drafted Bobby Portis. We had Bobby on our board rated much higher. He was sliding. And now we were actually targeting that year some players that could be potential backup point guards for us.
Mm-hmm.
And now it looked like we were going to get one of those at the 22nd pick. But I raised my hand and said, well, wait a minute. We know what and this is under John Paxton and Gar Forman, our rule is we stay right with our draft order. And Portis is above those guys and he's sliding. And we revisited our process right there in conversation and said, yep, if Bobby drops to 22, we're going to take him. And it did. And we got a draft pick. And even now, it's funny, I saw the Bucks play the other day. Oh, he's suspended right now, but I saw the Bucks play at Golden State on Tuesday night. And one of the things I was looking at their stats, and Bobby's still averaging 14-8, and he's like his 12th year in the league. And he's a tough son of a gun.
Yeah.
So I think that's it's not just whether somebody leapfrogs over you, but somebody for some reason that doesn't make sense to you is dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the case with Bobby, and I'm glad we got him. And Savage is a really good player.
Yeah, Coach. Let's take a couple minutes here. Let's wrap up on this. Just a lot of people are really, really excited about this draft. Especially, you know, obviously the couple of players that really stick out. Of course, Cooper Flagg. You know, the two kids from Rutgers, VJ Edgecombe. You know, the center from Duke, Malouche. I'm sorry, I'm butchering your name.
Mal-watch.
Yep. So I know, you know, again, just out of respect for the organization, not going to go into specifics, but, you know, just how's this draft looking compared to maybe some of the previous four or five drafts that we've seen the last few years?
I'm going to change topics on you just briefly to say that, yes, I agree with you completely. We're going to discuss this draft, but next year's draft is also very good. With A.J. DeBus, probably the name that most people know, the players who's going to go to the BYU.
Yep.
But this year's draft, yes, there is a good draft. Most people have anointed Flagg as the number one pick. That could change, but assuming he is number one, beneath him, there are some very good players as well.
Yep.
It will be dominated, as always, by freshmen. And people go, why? Well, the why is that if you think you could project his development, players going to probably develop more between ages 19 and 21 than he is between 22 and 25. Mm-hmm. And those 22 and 25-year-olds are the older guys. Now, I would always argue, I want to see potential, but I also want to see some track record.
Yep.
Well, obviously, Cooper Flagg has shown you some track record.
Yep.
And so some of the other players, as you mentioned, VJ Edgecombe, has had a great year at Baylor. So I think it's going to be dominated by freshmen as normal for those reasons. And there'll be a significant foreign influence. And that's what a lot of people who follow the NCAA basketball don't tie into as much, nor should they.
Yeah.
But there is definitely an influence of Europeans, the Aussies, that are going to be involved in the draft. And some of that European influence revolves around France. Victor Wembanyama, obviously a great French player. But I tell people all the time, don't shortchange France in the 2028 or the 2032 Olympics, because France has very good young players.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember watching the Nike Hoop Summit and the point guard that they had on that French team. I was like, ooh, yeah, that guy. Yeah, that guy can really, really play. And 3 years from now, I think he's going to be a handful on the international stage. And yeah, I might have to start digging into my tickets for the 28 Olympia. You know, I got some talking to Mom Plum here. But we've kind of eyeballed that a little bit to try and get out to Los Angeles for that. And I might have to cash in every single chip that I have just to get into a couple of games. I think it would be so cool to check out and see. So,
Mark Spears, the ESPN basketball writer.
Yeah.
Is a good friend of mine. It goes way back. Go back to him being a kid at our basketball camps in San Jose State when I was an assistant there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Mark said to me, he went to the Olympics this year, and he said it was the most meaningful, seeing the quarterfinals was the most meaningful experience in observing basketball he's ever had.
And
the quality of the play and how, just the quality of play and how hard people played for their country.
Wow.
And the energy in the building. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
Great. So you mentioned seeing Traore play in the Hoop Summit game last year. I'm going to jump back to our Still Valley connection. Marshall Cho, who coaches the international team in the Hoop Summit, mm-hmm. who is of Korean descent, was a longtime high school coach in Portland. He was my roommate at Still Valley, Iowa.
Okay.
He's a Still Valley guy. So the influence that Snow Valley and Don Showalter has had, and you'll talk about more in more depth in a couple of weeks, but it's how we met. And this all deals with a fraternity of basketball coaches, which is part of what somebody asked me the other day, well, at your age, why don't you retire? I don't want to retire. I like what I do.
Yeah.
Well, what do you like most about it? I like being able to be around basketball people.
Yeah.
Now, you know Greg Lansing, right?
Yes. Yeah. Former Iowa guy.
Long time. Former Iowa guy, yep. Head coach in the NCAA. He's now a scout for the Phoenix Suns. And at the Garden last week, at Madison Square Garden, we were sitting next to each other. And we were talking about this. We just enjoy talking basketball. Now, a lot of the guys around us that are scouts are guys that never had a whistle around their neck.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean they're not good at what they do. I'm sure they're probably better than I am. Mm-hmm. But I can't have that same conversation as we're watching a game on why the guy do this? Why did the guy attack the zone in this way?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm slaying the players. But if I'm a around another basketball guy, I can talk basketball.
Yeah.
And being around that is part of the reason I stay doing what I do. In fact, is this the main reason why I do what I do?
Yeah.
Awesome stuff, Dave. I appreciate your time here. I hope your eyeballs, just like everybody else's, are able to get through the next few days and weeks here as we stare at screens nonstop for 12 or 14 hours a day here. Coach, if there's any way that folks could reach out to you, maybe garner more information about your thoughts on building teams or whatever it may be, is there any way you'd be willing to share any contact information in that way?
Yes, go to my Bulls email. These is D Bullwinkle. That's Bollwinkel, D Bullwinkle at Bulls.com. If people want to talk about teamwork development, I love to discuss it with anybody at any time.
Perfect. Perfect stuff. Coach, thanks so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed your debut appearance on A Pen and a Napkin. We've had a few conversations the last couple of months here, but the first time we've recorded something for public consumption here. So I hope it's been good for you. Yep. If you could hold the line here just a second, we're going to wrap up again. Thanks so much to Dave Bullwinkle, scout for the Chicago Bulls, lifelong basketball junkie. Really appreciate his time. We want to thank Cosac Chiropractic. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. Download, rate, review, give us 5 stars. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Want to thank, once again, Coach Bullwinkle. It's a crazy time for him, and he took his time to talk to us here today. So, coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.